when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
In 2020, events have yet again shone a light on racial inequalities across the globe. Australia is not an exception. 20 years on from the reconciliation walks of the year 2000, this nation's journey towards a more just, equitable, and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to their elders past, present, and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
Mate, this is just impossible.
Too many people were confused.
You bet you are. You bet I am.
I have always believed in miracles.
That's not a policy.
Not now. Not ever.
I mean,
these comments are completely inappropriate.
Oh, I'm sure she's right.
But I ain't spending any time on it.
How pathetic.
You're a classic space invader.
Disgusting, mud-sucking creatures.
You should be ashamed of yourselves.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
Well, hello there, Mark Kenny here with what is actually the very last Democracy Sausage Extra for a year that perhaps, with the exception of Scott Morrison, nobody really rates. I mean, where the hell did it come from? You'd think with a number like 2020, we would all have seen it coming. But then, perhaps as the lament goes, it's only hindsight for which we have 2020 vision.
Oh, that's it. I'm leaving.
Luckily, hindsight is our focus for this last pod because we're going to have a bit of a laugh about a few things that happened in the fettered world of politics with my friends Dr. Maria Teflaga and Professor Frank Bongiorno. Howdy to you both.
Hi there.
Hello,
hi.
Mark. How are you?
I'm well. I'm looking forward to this. Now, Frank, no doubt in your sort of intellectual preparation for this rigorous process of arriving at all of these awards, you wrote a terrifically caustic, somewhat tongue-in-cheek piece for The Conversation, which was published just yesterday, and you cast the political year of 2020 as a sort of oldie-worldy tale with an obdurate king who tries to ignore the great warming, as you described it, and then confronts the great pestilence and gets dragged along by a few dukes and duchesses along the way. It was a lovely piece. Tell us how you came up with that.
Oh, I thought a fairy tale or a fable was the only way of dealing with 2020, especially at this end of the year when everyone's exhausted and needs a bit of a laugh. But it's had a bit of a fairy tale quality to it at times, hasn't it?
It has.
It's been mystical.
Yeah. People who've believed one thing and then turned out to believe something else or said one thing and changed completely. There's been a lot of that. And there's just – and there have been some phantom things, as I think you pointed out so well in that piece, you know, with the little sort of metaphor about – well, not really metaphor, but the reality of the pins in strawberries that we saw. What was that last summer? And turned out not to really have a lot of substance to it.
Yeah. I mean, it struck me that, you know – the world where politicians could get excited, indeed prime ministers could get excited about something like, you know, pins in strawberries or, you know, what the tax rate should be for backpackers, you know, the really big issues in Australian politics in the last few years seems like a kind of another world rather than just a couple of years ago. Yeah,
right. That's right. So we end up with like massive issues that render those sort of things almost comical, particularly because a couple of them actually are, you know, that really amounted to nothing, didn't it? What was it, a hoax, wasn't it, in the end?
Well, it was a straightforward criminal law matter if it wasn't a hoax. And, it was sort of inflated into some sort of national crisis.
Yeah.
And this is what a real national crisis looks like
exactly.
In 2020. Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting point because you're a historian, right? I mean, this year has just been extraordinary. We think about the way it started with the drought turning into the worst bushfire crisis we've ever seen. That quickly gives way to a pandemic, a global pandemic, which, you know, takes a little while to kind of for people and governments to get their heads around, but pretty damn quickly we realize the world is fundamentally changing, and we see governments doing things that, you know, we imagined were just not possible or would never be needed. I mean, as a historian, it's a bit hard, I suppose. You deal with, you know, looking back on things, and we're in the middle of this still, but, you know, can you imagine where there'll be a year like this? I mean, I'm not really asking you to predict the future, but
I think he is.
Yeah, I think I did. But, you know, is this one of those things where it seems bigger than it is? I mean, history's going to look back on this year as a really significant turning point.
Yeah, I mean, we don't quite know how yet because we don't know what's going to happen next, and that's the trick that historians pull, you know, that use of sort of perspective and hindsight. But, yeah, it's been pretty amazing for the different sort of things it's combined. So, yes, it looks somewhat like the year of the Spanish flu, you know, sort of 1919, I guess, for Australia. But, you know, it's had all these other aspects too, massive bushfire crisis and a recession, which you didn't really get with the Spanish flu. You basically got an economy recovering from the sort of awfulness of the war years. So, it's been different from 1919 and pretty amazing for the way it's combined lots of different things. And, of course, the international news this year has been, so dramatic as well with the presidential election. Mm. You think of
– the most significant presidential election, really, because the Trump, yeah, you know, juggernaut, the circus really of that administration has been such a front-of-mind thing, really, for even outside of the US. So – It rolling to its messy conclusion. I mean, even as we record this, they're just doing the electoral college votes, and Trump's still clinging on, saying that it's been stolen from him, and
And his triumph looked so inevitable, really, didn't it? At the beginning of the year, I mean, I think many people had taken for granted there was just going to be another term, and all of that evaporated over the course of the year with the kinds of crises we've been talking about, and in the American case too, of course, Black Lives Matters, which was very transformative.
Yeah. Events, dear boy, events.
Events, yes.
I think what is really kind of interesting, I guess, to sort of think about it in how might future historians look at this time from my perspective, it looks like that this crisis has accelerated certain processes that would have taken a bit longer to sort of play out, and we kind of can see that in, I guess, a sort of big policy shifts on climate change, for example. But the thing that I think will be most interesting is actually to look at what people's visions of the future, what they thought the future would look like in the darkest days of the pandemic, and quite likely how those things do not pan out. And I think that will be very, very revealing of, I guess, where we were kind of at psychically and as a society and as a culture when we kind of compare what we imagine for ourselves and what we actually end up achieving.
Yeah. And just on that question about, you know, Trump possibly rolling onto a second term, most presidents do get a second term. It's not always the case, but mostly they do. I can't say I was convinced about that, but we'll never know one way or the other. But if we can make that assertion at least as a sort of a reasonable proposition, I think it is, we could also make a similar one about Australia, which is to say that absent the pandemic, Morrison came out of the bushfire crisis looking utterly terrible, and the pandemic really, you know, sort of overtook everything. And right on the back of, and I've made this point on this podcast before, but right on the back of, you know, handling that very poorly, you know, the Hawaii holiday and then the sort of, you know, obfuscation about everything and the way he handled it, the insensitive way that he handled it, he really did glimpse his political mortality. And the pandemic came along and he had a chance to do it better, to respond.
Yeah, a moment for reinvention.
Yeah, so I mean, there's no greater point really than there is in talking about whether Trump could have won or not, I guess. But we could probably say, at least on the data then, that Morrison would have had a much tougher year, even though it's been an extraordinary year for extraordinary workload for the Prime Minister and for other political leaders. And I guess we can come to that. So let's go to our first category. And I think in keeping with the innate dignity of this august institution, we should start out with something uplifting, affirming, even positive. So, in the category of most flagrant and self-interested backflip, the nominees are Matthias Cormann for his sudden change on climate change, Kevin Rudd for suddenly campaigning and wanting a royal commission into the Murdoch empire, the Morrison government on New Start, JobSeeker, JobKeeper, debt and deficit spending, school closures, state border closures, going to the football, and who can forget wearing masks. So what do we think? You know, there's a clutch of them, Matthias Cormann, Kevin Rudd, the Morrison government.
I don't know what you're trying to say, Mark. Yeah, it has been a real year for black backflips. I think you were telling me before we were recording a sort of contrast, I suppose, in Matthias Cormann's rhetoric around climate change. Perhaps you can.
Well, I mean, yeah, because Cormann's interesting, isn't he? He was a sort of a right winger within this government right up until recently, the finance minister for a long time. Something of an ideologue, certainly a cynic when it came to, or a skeptic when it came to climate change.
Well, he was you know, one of the key people to unpick Malcolm Turnbull the first time around.
Exactly.
Part of that slew of ministers who resigned from the shadow cabinet.
Well, he was a critical person to switch sides on the Wednesday of that week in 2018. Yes, 2018. Was it 18?
It was.
Yeah.
It's that long ago.
Yeah, it is that long ago. And which really undid Malcolm Turnbull's leadership, you're right. So let me just give you an example of the double pike with backflip, or however you describe it. And that is, this is Cormann, right, talking in the last few weeks in relation to his bid to become a head of the OECD, right? In his vision statement, he describes, he says that effective global action on climate change is a must, and we must get to zero net emissions as soon as possible. That sounds reasonably enlightened. But in this very same year, he was speaking on Sky, that is going back to February of this year, when Labor had announced its net zero by 2050 target. He described that his response to that was making commitments, meaningless commitments, without actually properly assessing what the economic cost is, the impact on jobs, the impact on power prices, and the impact on emissions is extremist and irresponsible. So he's not telling that to the people he's looking, courting OECD votes for. So I think that's pretty graphic.
That's true. And what have we always admired Matthias Cormann for? You know, like he's so good at the message, you know, doesn't deviate from him. He's the person you trust to put in front of the camera and stonewall. And I guess what we're sort of seeing now is precisely this skill set on display. And so, you know, the OECD should definitely appoint him to that role.
Possible they will. Who knows? I mean, the federal government, of course, has spent vast amount of money on flying him all around the world. I think he's visited 20 countries, on an Air Force jet in order to secure this this job. It's
still airline food, Mark. Still airline food.
I couldn't help. It reminded me. I have to say, I tweeted on this of a very old advertisement that Maria will certainly be too young to remember, but Mark may well remember, for Imperial Leather, the soap.
Ah, yes.
There's sort of the family in this kind of Roman bath type outfit enjoying luxury, and it basically, the dialogue goes, Tahiti looks nice. And this is a woman. The husband replies, gets on the phone and says, Simon, Tahiti. You see a pilot saying, Roger, Wilco, and they're in an aeroplane.
Yeah, that's right. They're in their own jumbo, and and it sort of banks to the right or whatever, which is, or banks to the left in Matthias's view now. He's obviously banking to the left.
Obviously, banking's the word for it. Yeah.
And
also, climate change is still cultural Marxism. Is that where we're up to?
We've descended to that level instantly. So, and look, I think in fairness to the Morrison government as a general, if you can talk about backflips, there's a number that I listed off there, right? New Start, JobKeeper, JobSeeker, you know, improving New Start and by giving it the COVID allowance,
and the direct wage subsidy, which initially the government was going to do. And of course, its whole, you know, move to use the budget to inject money into the economy to keep people employed and so forth. These things are backflips in a sense, but they are necessary backflips. And I think, you know, no one's arguing they shouldn't have done it. No one anywhere really with any credibility on you know, right across the spectrum. So, you know, I think it'd be, probably churlish to, you know, call that a backflip and give, you know, I think
it would be hypocritical on our part, given we're always advocating, you know, evidence-based policy and reasonableness and, you know, being able to revise one's position.
That's right. It gets a little bit iffy when you get into the second part of that. You may recall I listed off school closures, state border closures, going to the football and masks. On all of those things, the feds were either, you know, sand in the gears or just straight out, you know, resistant. And they've been, all of them, part of Australia's success story. So, you know, not everyone. In fact, I don't think any single government's got everything right in terms of timing and all that. But the feds have been lucky here that the states have had perhaps a more direct relationship with their voters and decided to act in that way, and or with their constituents, I should say, and have decided to act in that way. And the aggregate result for the country has been good. And, you know, to be fair to Morrison, the National Cabinet was an excellent idea and it did work. Although, as you said yesterday in your piece, Frank, it's given the impression of everyone agreeing even when they didn't, which is, you know, not a bad impression.
It's not a bad impression. I mean, I think that's what you've said is a good sort of description of the way the federal system worked. Because I'd also argue that I think in some ways the federal government also moderated some instincts at the state level that weren't terribly helpful either. I mean, I've always felt that they overdid border closures, and I don't think they had a reasonable kind of roadmap, I guess, to reopening those borders. You know, you had situations where there were basically no infections either side of sort of the South Australian, Western Australian border, and yet no talk even of opening it at one stage. So, It kind of cuts both ways, but I agree that you know, the sheer power that I guess the state governments have been able to exercise, and which we've been reminded of, that they hold sway over so many kind of aspects of everyday life, health, education, just a whole range of things that kind of affect how we live our lives, means that they were, I think, drastically able to moderate, you know, some of the impulses coming from the federal government and from Morrison in particular.
Very sage point, I think. And what do we think about, you know, Kevin Rudd's conversion on Murdoch? I mean, the Murdoch press lined him up pretty well a couple of weeks ago with a front page story from David Pemberthy talking about the extent to which Rudd spent a lot of his time, you know, cozying up to the Murdoch press. And I certainly know that from my time in the gallery. Things were getting handed to people, stories and so forth, and you just think, God, you know. But
well, he's not the first, and he won't be the last.
He's joined, of course, by Malcolm Turnbull.
That's right. So, you know, across the aisle, hand in hand.
Two people that basically hate each other's guts, from what I can tell. I mean, judging by Turnbull's response to Rudd's bid for the UN Secretary General spot, I mean, bang, that was.
I guess it points to something that. I guess academics have known for a long time, but perhaps isn't always appreciated by the general public, which is just the level of media concentration in Australia. I mean, I've been reading that sentence in books dating from the 80s. So it's a long-term problem in this country. And so whilst, Kevin Rudd is definitely a hypocrite, like most politicians who will do whatever it takes to get elected, there is, like, I think, an essential kind of truth there that our country kind of needs to reckon with, which is, are we actually okay with the ever decreasing number of voices in our polity and the fact that we're getting
news deserts? Is it really ever decreasing? I mean, we've got more people, we've got more online platforms. I mean, in some ways it's a more varied media picture than it was in the past. I mean, I'm not saying that this isn't a valid criticism of the News Corp stable. You know, there are many people who take that view, but there's also a whole lot of new players. You know, the Guardian's there, and you know, Crikey, and a whole range of sort of smaller online players.
I guess so, but how many of them still have that capacity to set the agenda? I mean, that's a fair point. I wonder how many of them will still be there in 10 years' time.
There's democracy sausage.
Well, that's right. There's democracy sausage, home of breaking news.
Yeah. Home of breaking something.
That's right. Exactly. As a result of too many sausages.
So, look, let's tear open the envelope and see who's won, even though, in fact, we are the ones who are deciding this. So just put that envelope open now. And the winner is – it's Matthias Cormann.
Very well deserved.
Yes, yeah. Very well deserved. Done. Wow, congratulations.
He said he wouldn't be back. I think he said I won't be back as the final – in his final speech to the Senate, but he should have said, I won't be backflipping, but turns out.
And we can be assured too that if the OECD thing doesn't come off, that there'll be some ambassadorship or high commissionership available for him in due course.
Yes, always a soft landing. Yeah. Now, the next category.
Don't know what historical precedent there is for that, Frank.
The next category is a category that perhaps won't be around next year if we do this same awards presentation, and I can't imagine that we wouldn't after the ratings that this is almost certain together. But and that is, but then again, it might be around in a couple of years' time if he comes back, and that is it's been named Maddest Moment of the Trump Presidency. Now, I'll let you speak to this one, to some of these nominations, but these are the nominations. The Four Seasons Total Landscaping Moment, Goya Beans, Trump with the Bible outside St. John's in Washington, D.C. Now, I'll let you speak to those, Frank.
Four Seasons. They are three. I mean, there are so many mad moments, but there I think are. 2020 produced certainly some of the most visually kind of impactful, I think I'd describe them. And
it's an ugly word.
It is a very ugly word, impactful. Not one I'd use in print, but I'm going to use it here.
As long as you don't say learnings, I think I'll let it go by.
That's right.
But I have learnings.
But, yeah, I mean, the St. John, the Bible outside St. John, St. John's in Washington, D.C.
That was just egregious, wasn't it?
It was egregious because, yes, I mean, it involved clearing protesters with tear gas beforehand.
Punching reporters in the face even, including one of our own.
It was completely appalling, and he sort of stood there holding the Bible upside down, which I think had been produced by Ivanka out of her, no doubt, extremely expensive handbag, really, if I remember rightly.
I thought you were going to say out of her extensive library. But
she may well have an extensive library. Goya Beans, though, was completely bizarre. So this is the one where, in fact, I don't really know the full story, but that there was a very strongly pro-Trump sort of corporate person who is the owner of Goya Beans, which are, popular in the Latino community as a staple. And, there were suggestions of a boycott
I can't remember his name, Inuo or something. Yeah. He actually talked about Trump as being like the greatest president ever. He was, effusive in his praise of the orange one. And, yes, many people in the Latino community thought back to the way the president's spoken about Mexicans, for example, as criminals and rapists.
And of course, this resulted in Trump and Ivanka holding up cans of beans, right?
Which is. Ivanka did a particularly, attractive photo of her with a tin of beans.
Yeah. it was inspiring.
It was absurd. It was
like a 1950s advertisement.
Exactly.
So there was that one. The third you mentioned, Four Seasons Total Landscaping. Well, we don't really know the full story behind this, but, Rudy Giuliani held a post-election press conference, media conference there, basically to claim the usual, the election was fraudulent.
Yeah, this was quite early on. This was within 24 hours of the result, I think.
It was at a very early stage. And, the best explanation, I guess, is that it was meant to be held at the Four Seasons Hotel in Philadelphia, but in the confusion,
they gave
the wrong address and ended up outside a total landscaping place. But the story, I think, is completed by the fact that the neighbouring businesses were a crematorium and a pawn shop. That's P-O-R-N, not P-A-W-N, which, of course, on social media soon translated into a dildo shop.
Yeah, that's right.
That's the description used. And it just seemed like a wonderfully symbolic end, really, to the Trump presidency. And, of course, the owners of that business being, you know, sort of, I guess,
entrepreneurs
yeah. have really been milking it.
They've made T-shirts and everything. And, yeah. I think there's one image that I'd actually, like you're talking about, it had reminded me, which was do you remember when Trump advocated drinking bleach?
Oh, that was good too.
Yeah, and they cut away to the health official who's just like looking in horror.
She was ashen faced.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean,
he'd also suggested at that stage the use of extraordinary. What was it? Tremendous. He's a big fan of the word tremendous, and he tremendously bright light. If you could shine a tremendously bright light inside people, and perhaps you could do some wonderful things with disinfectant.
Is that where Pete Evans got the light box idea from?
Pete Evans, he's another favourite. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. I mean, for me, it's the Four Seasons moment. Like, I felt like the fitting end to what has sort of been like a surreal, reality TV show come like an endless episode of Arrested Development. For those of you too young to know that show, children, I suggest go and watch it. It's very good. But, you know, like it just sort of seemed to be the perfect cherry on top, which was on what was just a series of increasingly unbelievable events that were truly actually happening. And this wasn't like a fever dream.
And Giuliani looked like a kind of, you know, two-bit suburban lawyer, didn't he? You know, sort of standing out the front.
Well, I mean, the other one that we could have put in there was that appalling one not so long ago where he did the press conference to once again declare that, you know, they had an open and shut case to prove that, you know, the election was rigged, and even his hair dye was giving up and making a run for it down the side of his face.
All the time he fired it on national TV. Like, that was last week. Twice.
So who are we going to give this to? I mean, I could pretend to open the envelope, but the truth is
maybe
it's now empty.
Maybe all of the children are prize winners.
All of the children?
Maybe. It's a prize for everyone.
Every child gets a prize.
It's Christmas. Give a prize to everyone. I'd vote for Toto. I thought Four Seasons was one of the great political.
One of the great metaphors of a dissembling, you know, shambolic regime,
It was one of those things which often happens these days, and particularly in connection with the Trump presidency, you sort of wonder, is that a fake news? Is it a satire? And then you read the story and it's not.
I just feel like the last 4 years.
It did get hard to satirise, and I was thinking, you know, some comedians have had a lot to work with, but sometimes they've had, you know, they actually had to compete with reality itself for total bizarreness. All right, well, let's give it to the Four Seasons although I did, you know, speaking of advances, right, because someone presumably would have advanced that, you know, that is the people in political campaigns who go ahead and check out a venue and make sure it's all right. Mm. Someone made the point on Twitter, and I thought it was a beautiful point. Do you see that picture of Trump not so long ago? It was only sort of 10 days ago. We were sitting at that tiny little table signing something or other, and it just someone tweeted that, you know, they take their hat off to the advancer who walked into the room, looked at that tiny table and said, yeah, that'll do.
That'll do. Exactly.
It made Trump look
I personally think on January 20, it's going to be revealed that this was just a 4-year live art show.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, that's right.
Exactly. And it would be declared the greatest piece of art ever.
The greatest installation piece.
That's right, exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know.
Performative and.
It may have challenged one of the oldest republics, but hey, think of the ratings.
Oh, yeah,
Four Seasons also kind of closed the 2020 circle because they also put out a particular image you could use as Zoom background, and of course it's the Four Seasons total landscaping.
That's right.
Which I think is a wonderful sort of statement on 2020.
Perfect.
The year of Zoom. I mean, maybe it should be called the year of Zoom.
The year of Zoom.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly been one of the great winners, hasn't it? Yeah. Look, we're going to take a break in a sec, but just we'll do one more before we do, and that is gently categorised as biggest dill. Now, we've already mentioned a couple of these, Donald Trump, Rudy Giuliani. Now we throw in Boris Johnson. And my friend Paul Pickering makes the point that, you know, Boris really gets there because he's actually smarter than some of these guys, but it doesn't matter. He still plays the fool rather well. Let's face it, the performance of that government, particularly in response to the coronavirus, has been shambolic and continues to be. I mean, they're actually going into tier 3 lockdown in London at the moment, but they're still talking about having some sort of Christmas holiday from the conditions. I mean,
Yeah.
It is. And look, we'll add to those Peter Evans, the aforementioned.
Light box. $1,500 light box.
Yeah, speaks for itself. And Craig Kelly, the Liberal backbencher, who, and I'll quote Ann Davies from The Guardian here, who asked the question a little while ago, what do supporting hydroxychloroquine as a treatment for COVID-19 and climate change denialism have in common? Apart from dwindling body of scientific support for either, the two causes have united some of the world's most conservative politicians, from the outgoing US President Donald Trump to the Australian Federal MP Craig Kelly. And Kelly, of course, has been a big fan of hydroxychloroquine, if that is in fact how you say it.
That's how you say it. Yeah.
And, you know, he's also warned at one point that it would be, going back to, harking back to Matthias's view, that it would be political suicide for Scott Morrison to adopt net zero by 2050, which someone needs to tell Matthias, because he's out there spruiking it to the world. So there's our list of deals. I was going to call this biggest knob, but, you know, I decided that would be impolite. So I've gone for dill, which was a favourite word of Laurie Oakes, and I figure we can
hide behind the great man. Is that like a backhanded compliment? You know, like I was going to say that you're a knob, but I've downgraded you to dill.
Just a dill.
Well, that's right, just a dill. Yeah. There's a certain sort of mediocrity to this at the end of the day, right? So Donald Trump, Rudy Giuliani, Boris Johnson, Peter Evans and Craig Kelly. Notice they're all blokes, by the way, which
women have to lift their game.
They do. You know? They are underrepresented.
I'm disappointed. Yeah. I guess my money is on Boris for the very reason that you said that he is cleverer than that. And I guess I just keep thinking about how he was shaking people's hands
yeah, that's
in COVID
right.
hospitals. And then, of course, faced death as a result of getting a really serious illness.
That's so, very true. Yeah. And then he came out talking about the NHS being the beating heart of Britain, which which is terrific and all that, but it's still underfunded.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're going to go for Boris? Are you happy with Boris?
I'm happy with Boris, and I'd do it on the grounds. There's a brilliant investigation by the Sunday Times Insight team, which has basically shown that that government made exactly the same mistake twice. Now, most of us learn, don't we? You know, you make a really big mistake and the second time round you sort of tread more carefully. But they made exactly the same mistakes in September that they'd made back in March, and people are paying for it with their lives on a grand scale.
Yeah.
To read this particular story about the decision-making process in September is just heart-wrenching, actually.
Yeah, I read that piece. Yeah. It was a really brilliant piece. Yeah. It was a really extraordinary piece, and I agree with you. It's tragedy to think that Australia has done well, and New Zealand as well, are making some virtue of the natural advantage of being an island. Britain has that advantage as well, albeit that it's much more connected to the international community and to Europe in particular. But nonetheless, they kept their borders open for a long time. And even in between what we might now look at as the first wave and the second wave, there were vast numbers of people travelling to the continent for their summer holidays. And it was virtually being encouraged and coming to and from Spain and so forth. So
it took them months to introduce a quarantine.
They've never really been properly serious about it.
No.
Even as their hospitals were overwhelmed. So it's been puzzling. Really, to see particularly sort of conservative, recalcitrant governments sort of wrestling with the sort of idea of the kind of government fiat and control that was required by this emergency. The same people that would presumably pull those levers in the case of war, but just did not want to pull them here. And the reluctance, it's a bit like half catching a cricket ball. You just end up with broken fingers, you have to do this properly because half doing it is like not doing it at all.
Which I think is what we've sort of seen in the infection rates and the fatality rates.
Yeah, and it's no laughing matter at all.
No, right? No.
And the distractions of Brexit, I think, are also an issue there, aren't they?
Well, precisely. That's been a debacle all the way through and continues to be. Let's take a quick break and we'll come back with some more positive ones, I think, on the other side of the break.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. Now, let's talk about, as I said, some positive ones. Most effective political leader. This will be in the international category, okay? So the nominees are, and you can add to these if you like, Jacinda Ardern, Angela Merkel, Scott Morrison. Scott Morrison's going to come up in the local one as well, so but we'll leave him there for the time being. And Tsai Ing-wen in Taiwan, who's been included in Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People of 2020 and certainly performed very, very effectively there. Any thoughts, any responses?
I guess from my perspective, it would probably have to be Jacinda Ardern because she has succeeded on multiple fronts this year, like not only in effectively managing the global pandemic from her own shores, but winning a historic election, like a landslide in a voting system that makes it extremely difficult for any party to win a majority.
It's sort of designed so that no party has a majority.
Precisely.
And such has been the kind of acclamation from voters that they have a majority, yeah.
Yeah, and her capacity to bring together her community at a time of sort of great crisis and strife, all whilst using a form of positive politics, which we haven't seen around for a very long time. And that I think is actually very impressive across multiple fronts.
I really like that point, actually, the point you make about using a form of positive politics, because she is actually kind of, rowing her own race. She's not following a template of anyone else. She's got a very positive approach to the way and a very unifying approach to the way. We saw that most graphically demonstrated in those terrible hours after the Christchurch massacre. But she's really governed like that. That's just an extreme moment where we saw it. But that has been a kind of an ethos of her government. It's not, as any government is, not without its faults around the edges, but it's a successful thing. But I guess, Frank, one thing we have seen is that all governments that have been half competent have been elevated during this crisis. So winning an election during it is perhaps, as we've seen in Australia with a number of state governments, it's not in and of itself impossible to do. Voters have tended to get behind governments during this time of uncertainty and fear and government problem solving. But nonetheless, she's done it with great purpose, and this is an emphatic endorsement, really. It's not just a win, but a very strong win.
And indeed, polling earlier had suggested it was going to be close, that I think there was a general view that she would probably win, but that she would certainly have to cobble together some kind of coalition or alliance again. It was pretty amazing. But, incumbency has worked, I guess, for governments that have shown a reasonable level of competence. The others that you mentioned, I suppose the jury has to be out really on Angela Merkel and Germany, simply because it appears to be going into a really difficult situation in terms of numbers of infections now.
Yeah.
Again, that's not necessarily down to her in particular, but the reality is, that Germany may well not escape the kinds of dreadful levels of infection we've seen a number of other European countries
countries.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it's interesting that Germany is a federation, but and I've seen Angela Merkel recently making very strong pleas to people from the Bundestag, from the chair there, or from the microphone there, really imploring people to observe all of the health warnings and new behaviours, but it's actually proving quite difficult, and perhaps that does underscore how successful we've been in Australia with the very high level of public buy-in for all of those changes, and also the fact that, I guess, as I said before, we're an island and we've been able to sort of close ourselves off from the world.
Which certainly helps. But I do recall her press conference, or several press conferences, where she very methodically explained, in a highly sort of scientifically literate way. It does remind us all of exactly why she has been such a successful political leader with such a vast legacy and, you know, a real class act.
Yes. All right. Well, look, let's say that this award goes to Jacinda Ardern. I know that is going to definitely boost her stocks quite a lot in New Zealand. I'm sure that she will be eagerly
She's been hanging out for this. Yeah. She can retire now.
It's possibly a big moment, I think, you know.
As an endorsement for another landslide in a few
years. That's right.
Years
yeah, exactly. That's right. Exactly.
Yeah. Or perhaps a kiss of death.
Exactly.
Now, most effective political need. This leads on to the domestic version of this, and perhaps this is really where Scott Morrison should be considered more. Most effective political leader national, that is in Australia, Daniel Andrews, Mark McGowan, Gladys Berejiklian, Scott Morrison, and the Queensland Premier, whose name momentarily escapes me.
Anastasia Palaszczuk.
That's it. Now, Palaszczuk, like Ardern, has won an election, and she's done so under a good deal of kind of external pressure. But I think, going back to your point before, Frank, I agree with you. I think the border closure thing was rather overplayed by some of the states. And there were some terrible stories, really, of, you know, people not being able to get across the New South Wales-Queensland border, including one story I heard on AM at one stage of a 14-year-old kid, you know, that needed, you know, heart checks because of a condition and unable to get a permit to go across and all that sort of stuff. And it seemed a bit churlish. Nonetheless, I think Palaszczuk has performed extraordinarily well.
So. Well, it's her third election win in a row.
Yeah, she's the first female leader to do that in Australia. That's not insignificant.
And against the background of the apparent vulnerabilities of the Labor Party in Queensland.
Yeah, it's got a primary vote nationally of about 25 or something percent. You know.
Yeah, and this, remember, it was a
I should clarify that it's primary vote federally in Queensland.
Yes.
You know, sort of last election was, I think, somewhere at 25-26%.
Yeah, and in, you know, obviously past violent swings in state politics, what, they were down to 7 seats at one election a few years back, was it 2012 or whatever? So
yeah, it's the one where she won government. Yeah, yeah. So, less than a cricket team.
Yeah, yes, that's right. She'll be able to get it back next time round. But, you know, it does, you know, underline the vulnerability of the Labor Party in Queensland, and she's managed, you know, extraordinary resilience, I think. Yeah.
And look, you know, for all the criticism of Morrison, and we talked about some of the things in which he was tardy at the start, and also things on which you know, he's sort of benefited from the, you know, the more muscular, more decisive action of the states. But nonetheless, he didn't just do the National Cabinet, which was an atmospheric changer of the relationship between the levels of government. It did bring the country together at a critical moment. But the other important thing I think needs to be said is that the economic policies that were put in place, which were so anathema to his party, and which have facilitated all of this. Even if you think about, you know, the, we've got Daniel Andrews on this list, for example, and I think were it not for the reason that he was in lockdown in the first place, you would have to say Andrews' performance is really, really extraordinary. Now, whether you subtract, you know, A from B or you don't, I guess, is a debate that, you know, people can have. But, you know, the feds were paying vast amounts into Victoria to effectively fund that lockdown. So, you know, I don't think it's inappropriate to consider Morrison's overall national leadership.
I think that, you know, considering where Scott Morrison started the year, where you know, there were serious questions over his judgment and his capacity. Like, I think on any objective measure, he has kind of done what you expect good leaders to do. He's learned from his own mistakes. He's grown. He's acted against the interests of his own voting blocs on occasions. You know, whether you like him or not, polling results suggest that he has been, broadly speaking, a unifying figure. And I think, you know, it would be simply just dishonest of us not to acknowledge that he has been really effective. Like, he has been able to recast his whole leadership brand this year, and not all political leaders have been able to do that. Mm. You know, and I think that is something that is important to consider, just like Dan Andrews' ability to show up to press conferences day after day and effectively stay relatively in control of that situation says a lot about his political skills. Mm. You know, like, these being a good leader doesn't always mean that our hearts are full of joy, right?
Yeah.
But effectiveness is.
Yeah, I mean, the very sort of criticisms, for instance, that Malcolm Turnbull made of Morrison in Turnbull's memoirs that appeared this year.
About which you wrote so wonderfully.
It was an interesting read, the book, and one way in which it was interesting was his portrait of Morrison, I think, in which he presents him unflatteringly on the whole, I think, but as someone who doesn't take too many glances back. That is, aren't too many issues on which Morrison would basically go to the wall. I mean, there are obviously some religious and moral issues that he feels very strongly about, but basically anything else he's willing to drop. And I think we've seen that this year.
Yeah, that comes out a little bit in Catherine Murphy's really wonderful quarterly essay as well. Mm. I think, you know, that he is very much a pragmatist, and he's serious about keeping the job. Do we cast against him, though, the government's intransigence on climate change? I mean, can we say at the end of 2020, when the world is moving, when American voters have made a decisive decision, it's a pretty big margin, actually, that Biden ends up winning by 7 million votes or thereabouts, a pretty emphatic win. And, you know, the Johnson administration, we've discussed before, but on climate is, you know, dramatically moving. There's a kind of a mood around the world for progress here, and Australia is basically making itself into a, you know, an international ne'er-do-well on this question. So I don't know if I can say about Scott Morrison, in light of that, that he's been the most effective leader. He's leading the country in the wrong direction in that regard.
I think what is really interesting about Scott Morrison, and I guess it sort of plays to his strengths as a political leader, is that he is very focused on the short term, and he's very tactically good. Broadly speaking, with the exception of the fires. And he is very much focused on winning the next election and is very deft at positioning himself and his government to maximise, I guess, the space he sort of has for himself. But on the questions of, I guess, like long-term policy change, well, even when it comes to dealing with the pandemic in terms of its impacts on the economy, you know, one of the criticisms that the Prime Minister has faced is that his government hasn't really declared what its reform colours are. It's not really clear what Australia is supposed to look like in 2030 and how our economy is sort of supposed to change. So much of what the government has been interested in doing is kind of restoring or going back. And that basically, when we sort of assess what is a good leader or who is a good leader, you know, are we talking about managing this immediate crisis? I think he gets a lot of points for that. But if we're talking about long-term strategic leadership, then no, I think the arguments you've made are pretty clear that this is definitely not his strength. But I guess, you know, given we're assessing him against other short-term leaders who are largely managing short-term problems, like, yeah.
Yeah, we've kind of been reminded – I mean, I think the point about his pragmatism is really important. But we've also been reminded in this pandemic that in Australia the centre held
all those years, the centre held. Yeah. So there was One Nation, but One Nation doesn't compete seriously for government. It can affect things through its preferences and all the rest of it. But compared to the kinds of impulses that were unleashed around issues like immigration in Europe, in the United States,
the UK with
Brexit, Trumpism, of course, the centre held in Australia. And you know, I think that point has really come out very strongly, as it did in New Zealand. I think as it broadly did in Canada, which has clearly had, although a difficult pandemic, nowhere near what we've seen in the United States. And I think that's been enacted in all sorts of ways this year.
So what are we deciding then? I mean, is that a case for Scott Morrison's overall general stewardship of the nation?
I don't know. I guess the thing we haven't really discussed is, sorry to open this conversation up again, is that whilst, you know, we've sort of seen him be really effective on, you know, managing this short-term crisis, like the government has sort of doubled, tripled, quadrupled down on its inability and its refusal to engage with questions of scrutiny, questions of accountability, and to a disturbing degree.
Well, that does come up in our next category, which is most risible explanation for a government or political failure.
Right, okay. Yeah. Well, that's certainly a spanner in the works. Yeah.
But you make a good point. So just to tie this one up, I mean, we've got in front of us Anastasia Palaszczuk, Daniel Andrews, Mark McGowan, Gladys Berejiklian. I mean, all of those state premiers have done well. I think the standout case there is Andrews. Because he did, as you said, Maria, he took tough, unpopular policy and then stood up and explained it every day. Now, you know, some people will say he obfuscated like politicians do, but certainly no worse than any other politicians going around at the moment. And I think it was anti-populism, as I've described it before. And in the end, extraordinarily effective, you know, notwithstanding that it comes from a stuff up to begin with. So I think to me, the choice is really between Andrews and Morrison on this, because I think Morrison, pandemically speaking, if that's a word, and you know, we're in the academy, we can make words up.
Yeah. That's actually the only thing we do all day.
What do you say?
Just make words up.
What am I bid for this? Let's make a decision here, because we're getting pretty. We've got a couple to get through.
I'm going to say Morrison.
Okay.
And the reason I'm going to say Morrison is, whilst I think that Andrew's performance at a, you know, as a professional politician and communicator particularly, was extraordinary, and holding the line and what's been achieved in Victoria is extraordinary. You know, in the end, he is a member of a government, has been there for 20 years, and if there are flaws in the public health system, he's got to carry some of the can for that. You know, they've been there except for 3 years since 1999.
Morrison's gone pretty well not carrying the can for the flaws in the aged care system in the very same state. But yes, look, I'm going to say Morrison as well, which basically makes your vote academic on this.
I'm actually quite happy with that. But can I just say that I'd like to award Mark McGowan the best kebab based comment?
That's right.
For the year.
Yes. And also and a special judge's mention for elevating the mullet into the central conversation.
Right.
So that brings us to most risible explanation for a government and political failure. The candidates, or the categories, the nominees, I should say, are Robodebt, which of course is a terrible debacle, Angus Taylor for his creativity in blaming the Sydney City Council for travel bills that it didn't have, and for a few other things. John Barilaro's Clayton's resignation from the ministry in which he was hoping to sort of sit on the crossbench with his Nationals colleagues but still have the white cars in the ministries.
Over koalas too.
Yeah, over koalas. Right, that's right.
Did he try to quit and join federal politics this year as well? Was that this year?
Yeah, precisely. He was a sort of a starter, non-starter for Eden Monero for the switch there, along with Andrew Constance, two members of Berejiklian's, and both of them hold the state seats that are contained within.
He was
federal.
Very rude on the phone, wasn't he?
Yes.
He was
they were rude to each other. Mm-hmm. It was as good as the famous phone call between, was it
Peacock?
Peacock and Kenneth.
Yeah.
Which was picked up by a ham radio enthusiast. And
can't quote on this program.
No,
we can't quote the other one either.
It's fair to say that they were reasonably frank in their assessment of John Howard at the time. Okay, so what do we think?
What about aged care?
Well, do I have that there? I actually, yes, I do actually have Michael McCormack during the bushfire crisis for branding conservationists as woke inner city lunatics. Of course, the other one that I've got on here is I don't hold a hose, mate, as a Hawaii explainer. That was yes. That was pretty good. There's Dan Tehan's attack on the Victorian Premier that we were just talking about when almost on the same day he said that he misspoke after unloading a heap of invective on Daniel Andrews. Colbeck, of course, the aged care minister, for not even knowing how many people were infected what the death toll was in the aged care homes. So yes, there's a fair bit. There's a long list here.
What about the time that Brendan Murphy, the chief health officer, shook hands on TV before he was supposed to, of course, not be shaking hands anymore?
Yeah.
Or the time when Scott Morrison was asked about the fact that women in Yass have to drive an hour in labour.
Oh, yeah, they're upgrading the hospital road.
Yeah, and his response was that they should be happy because they're upgrading the Barton Highway. And
I want to go with that one. I think that one was so absurd. Right?
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. That was a shock.
Yeah, don't worry. Yeah. We've got a better road, so you can you know, when you're in one of the laybys, it'll be so right, much exactly. better doing a roadside burn.
Your contractions might only be.
I think that's a really good choice for a winner because given that we, awarded him a positive one a moment ago.
Yeah,
that's right.
It really does need to be leavened by reminders of that kind, doesn't
indeed,
it?
Yeah, indeed, indeed. Yeah. Now, we move to a particular favourite of yours, Frank, which you've called the Barnaby Joyce Award for Conspicuous Canberra Bubble Behaviour. And you've just nominated the joint winners here. And we're not going to go into great detail here for reasons that might be obvious, but the joint winners are Alan Tudge and Christian Porter. I mean, these gentlemen speak for themselves, I guess.
There's a whole Four Corners special on it, yeah.
Yeah.
Now,
perhaps we could present the award at next year's ball,
Yeah, that's right, late in the evening.
No.
Let's move quickly on to the next one. Let's move quickly on to the next one, right? And now this is and we actually thought of this a few days ago and suddenly it's been a bit more poignant, I suppose. The John Le Carre Award for Creepy Deep State Behaviour. Now, unfortunately, as we record this, only today we've learned that the great John Le Carre, the world's best espionage novelist, has died. So that is the extent to which people have gone to stop this category going ahead. No, that's not true. But you can never say with the deep state. I mean, that's the whole point. The nominees are Christian Porter, P. We know as Porter, as he's occasionally known, for Bernard Collary and Witness K, and Christian Porter for Witness J. So he's nominated twice in this. Would you like to speak to this, Frank? Obviously,
yes.
With one of those things that changes your voice so no one knows who you are.
Oh, that's right.
I think we're forward.
Yeah, that kind of thing.
Well, I mean, it's obviously got to be Christian Porter, doesn't it? I can never get the
does
letter.
He win it for Witness K or Witness J? It's a very alphabetical sort of approach he has to.
I'm pretty biased. I'm so outraged by the Collary business that I'd vote for that one.
Yeah, I.
Yeah.
Now, this moves us on to Woman Man of the Year International. Now, the nominees I have are Joe Biden, Jacinda Ardern, and then I've got this third one that I've written in pencil here because it's a little bit controversial in the sense it's not an individual, but I just think it needs to be recognised somewhere. I'm calling it medical science. I mean, when you think about it, the extraordinary story really of this year on above everything else is the identification of vaccines so quickly and indeed all the other knowledge that has been gained in a very quick time and shared over this pandemic. So
it's hard to argue against that.
It is hard to argue against that, I think.
Especially when you sort of just think about
and we've given Jacinda Ardern Leader of the Year anyway.
Yeah.
And some people might argue, perhaps unkindly, that Joe Biden, was really just not Donald Trump. I mean, that was his strongest feature. And also, let's think back to when Obama was given the Nobel Peace Prize, you know, upon winning the presidency. The election, you know, yeah. It was too soon, right? So yeah. Let's say it's too soon for Biden. He hasn't actually done anything yet.
Yeah. The thing I'd say about Biden, I think he did prove a formidable professional politician over the course of, which he is, as we know, over
he
the
did.
Course of this year. There was no template for running a presidential election in those circumstances.
That's true. And he also was a beacon for civility very coarse and vituperative age.
Yeah, absolutely. And he had a lot of different kinds of pressures to negotiate to, you know, given the sheer levels of turbulence in the political system.
Well, we can go with Biden if you want.
No. I think the medical science one is a great idea.
Now, the Woman Man of the Year, National, that has Dan Andrews in it. We've discussed him a bit. It has Tsai Ing-wen from Taiwan, and it has, at my initiative recently, Bernard Collaery. And I just think I'm going for Bernard, frankly. I mean, this is a bloke who has acted in the national interest.
Yep.
And I think the government's pursuit of him in this through secret trials and or behind closed doors trials and so forth is an outrage. So that's where my vote goes.
Yeah. We're Canberra people. We're in the bubble. Let's give it to one of our own. Yeah.
Exactly.
So that closes out our awards except for one last one. And I realise we've been going for a long time, so I'll do this very quickly. So on a positive note for 2020, for all of its terrible news and loss, it might turn out to be a decade too late, but the year when climate change finally penetrated the defences of conservatism. We'll see about that because I think it's early days, but there does feel to be a shift that's going on now, and you can see it even in the Morrison government. Whether I don't think he's going to get Craig Kelly across the line, Scott Morrison, but it's pretty obvious, I think, where things are going. And that brings us to a last category, best podcast, best executive producer of a podcast. And there's only one nominee. There's only one nominee, and it's Martin Pierce. Now, I know we're going to have a spirited debate about this. But Martin has been the backbone of Democracy Sausage, which could explain why it's not so pleasant to chew, for the last 18 months or so. He's even presented the podcast a few times when I haven't been around. But alas, he's off to a job outside of ANU. And I think we're really going to miss him.
Oh, we are going to miss him.
We are.
I mean, yes. I object to giving this award because it'll just encourage him.
It will encourage him.
But we will miss him.
Yes, because he's just been such a, an enthusiastic, creative, positive force behind the scenes in this podcast all the time. I know I talk to him a lot through the week in terms of who we're going to have on, and we've had a lot of fun doing it. We've had people from all over the world, particularly with a great interest in Brexit, which both of us took a keen interest in. I know that on a personal note, I'm going to very much miss having Martin Pierce there. So he's just sitting in the same room at the moment.
He's blushing. It's true. The podcast wouldn't happen.
I want to very strongly acknowledge Martin's great contribution to this podcast and the work that he's done right across the university, which will be a loss to ANU. So
to Martin.
Thanks,
to Martin.
Martin
indeed.
To Martin.
Thank you, Martin.
Thank you, Martin.
Thank you. I'm sorry I didn't win biggest deal of
the year. We debated it, but we thought it was in poor taste.
There is a sealed section of this podcast in which you might win biggest deal of the year, but
I'm opening it now.
Yeah, that's right.
The most tyrannical podcast producer. Yeah.
That's right.
Finally, you get the director's cut of the Democracy Sausage.
See, the other thing behind my logic here was that I figured we've gone over length, and Martin, you know, does the editing of this. He's hardly going to cut the end off now, is he?
I mean, you know.
This is the time where we get to say what we really think. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Now, look, finally, let me just say this, Maria and Frank. This is the last Democracy Sausage podcast for the year. It's been an amazing year, as we've discussed so many times. So thanks both of you for, you know, everything you've done on the podcast this year. It's been really terrific. I know lots of people have, you know, had lots of positive things to say about your contributions. So, from me, thanks so much for all of that. And we'll look forward to 2021 when everyone thinks magically it's somehow going to be a whole lot better. And I guess at least until it gets here, we got to run with it.
It could get better.
You never know.
I'd like to thank everyone who listens to this podcast. It's it's gratifying to know that that you're so engaged with the podcast and and are here to enjoy the journey with us.
Yeah.
So thank you very much. And, you know,
and who knows, it could be an election year next year. And we started in an election year only about 18, 19 months ago during the 2019 election, you know, in the campaign there. And we could find ourselves around, well, sort of, you know, the third quarter, fourth quarter of 2021 having an election again. And I guess
great.
The story of that is that Scott Morrison, if he's doing that, it's probably because the economy is in better shape than many people thought it was going to be in, and that's certainly the evidence at the moment. Anyway, we could babble on like, or at least I could babble on like this for a long time, but thanks, Frank, for being here
again. Well, thank you, Mark. It's been an absolute pleasure to be on here, and thank you to Maria too and to Martin.
Indeed.
It's been wonderful.
Indeed. Bye for now.
Bye.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.